Hey, y'all, how's it going? Guess what? It's already time for the show again. Hooray! Oh, yeah. Ray is going to be on the show. Hooray. Ray McGovern will be on, and Phil Giraldi. And I'm working on David Enders. I don't know. He's in Iraq. Last minute kind of an arrangement. So maybe or not we'll get David Enders on the show. Wouldn't that be cool to talk to David again? Good old David. Anyway, so yeah, it's my show. And yeah, I know, it probably is, it probably does look bad if both of my guests on one show are former CIA guys. But it's Ray and Phil. They're great. What can I say? They're great. I like them. I don't know why a decent person would want to be a CIA guy. But anyway, as former CIA guys, they're both great writers. And they're against all the same stuff I'm against. So that's really all that counts to me. Hey, this thing I oppose, tell them good reasons why they should oppose it too. Go ahead. That's all that's going on here, really. And they've got that great argument from authority fallacy going on. Hey, I'm a former CIA officer, and I can tell you, fighting a war on terrorism is stupid. All right. So that's the show today. Ray and Phil. Phil and Ray. Ray will be talking about some things, and Phil some different things, and maybe some overlap. And then if we're lucky, we'll get David Enders to talk about the war. I told you yesterday, I went and... I think it was just a coincidence that while I was talking about him on the show, I was looking at Twitter and there was a tweet from him. Oh, no, that's not the coincidence. The coincidence was I was talking about how America fought an 8-year war for Iran in Iraq. And then the coincidence was I looked over and there was a tweet from David Enders, was being retweeted by somebody else, I guess. And it had a picture of a billboard promoting the Ayatollah and I presume the Bada Brigade or some other heroic Shiite militia. And it had not even Sistani, it had the Ayatollah Khomeini on it. And he was saying, boy, I never thought I'd see these all over Baghdad. Yeah, well. And in fact, he was being more specific, a formerly Sunni neighborhood. He was referring to good old David Enders. So anyway, let's see if we can get him back on. And, you know, I didn't even realize this. I knew that I had been interviewing David since 2005. But only just now I was Googling him, and I just saw, I didn't even really have a chance to read the thing, but I just saw about him that he went, at the age of 22, he went to Iraq to set up his own newspaper in 2003 with the invasion. At 22 years old. I didn't know that. Which means he was, 24, 25, something like that when I started interviewing him, and he was just reporting from there for other papers. I forget now who he was writing for then. I think the Washington Post or something. But writing good stuff since way back then, 10 years ago. That was when I first started interviewing him, so. It's a long time. He did great stuff on Libya in 2011 too, man. Great stuff. Alright, anyway. So hey, the Kickstart thing. Let me talk to you about that. Now, the thing about you guys is, you're very kind and generous. What a bunch of wonderful fans of the show I have here. Dare I hit refresh on this page at this Kickstarter? What happened was, we got $1,261 pledged so far on a goal of $675. So, and with 6 days to go, most of that happened. Well, not most of that. Yeah, most of that. The majority of that happened on the first day. Before the first 24 hours was up, you guys contributed more than I was asking for. Now, so here's the thing. I talked with Sneaker about the servers, and that's going to be about $1,400 more. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a separate Kickstarter for that later. But what I'm going to do is, and you know, because I got to send out books and silver coins and all these kind of rewards for the people who have pledged. So... once we pay the computer genius and cover all the costs, which the 175 over the 500 was supposed to cover the costs according to napkin math, but we'll see how it goes. And then, but whatever is left over from that will be held over, I promise you. Will be held over and applied to the next Kickstarter, which I hope we'll be able to get going here very soon. Because Sneaker says we really need these new servers. And they're going to be about $700 each. $750 something. So, anyway, that'll be the next Kickstarter. And I'll give you a breather, all you generous money donating people. Wait a couple of weeks and then kick that in. But then in the meantime, I'm really excited, man. We're about ready to go. I guess we have to wait the other 6 days. Is that how it works? I'm not that familiar with the Kickstarter thing. I think we got to wait the 6 days till the goal period is over. And then I'll get all your money and then I'll give it to that computer genius guy. And then he's going to get cracking on doing the job to get, first of all, to make sure that all the MP3 links on the site work, all the interviews are there. And then get them all uploaded to YouTube, which hopefully will mean a lot more new listeners and YouTube ad dollars. So it's a great project. I've gotten some emails and some comments and some different things from people saying they're really excited about it too. So thanks very much, everybody, for that. And I promise I'm not asking everybody to go ahead and go over and let's try to raise the whole amount for the servers too now. I thought I might do that since it seemed like we're on a roll here, man. But now time's ticking away and Sneaker told me just how much we really need to make now on that. And so I decided, nah, you know what? We should wait. We'll do a separate one for that. We'll make sure that, you know, in case our computer genius here says, you know, I could do tags on all of these, but writing that script's going to cost you another $100 or something like that. Then okay, we'll have that covered too. But no matter what, all this money is going straight into the business, straight into the show itself, and nothing else. So rest assured about that. And again, thank you, everybody. It's very kind of you. And now, so yeah, man, I guess I'm grateful. I'm really short on time for this segment. I just want to get this out of the way real quick. Again, it's about the Rand Paul thing. Had a big conversation with Justin Raimondo on Twitter about Rand Paul again. And this happens from time to time. And the difference between me and Justin is really trying to like Rand Paul, and I'm not anymore. I decided that I don't like this guy, I don't trust this guy, I know what he's about, and I just don't like him. And that was back in 2009. And man, you know, back when I was on Facebook, I would have these huge fights with people about this. And I would just say, look, he's already proven he's a bad guy. He's already proven that, you know, basically he's a weasel. He's willing to throw his father under the bus to endorse Mitt Romney for a not even shot at Paul Ryan's losing vice president spot on the Romney ticket. Are you kidding me? It just shows the kind of thinking that he goes through and where his priorities are. And when I first interviewed him, he was bad on Guantanamo. He's bad on Iran. He's bad on all kinds of things. And the best he can ever do is be half-ass good on things. Here he is. He's actually live right now on C-SPAN. And, well, he's talking about the Constitution, but whatever. He wants to declare war on the Islamic State. He's as bad or worse as anyone else in the Congress on ISIS. In fact, in wanting a full-scale declaration of war against them, he's really out ahead of John McCain. He is to the right of John McCain on the ISIS war. Now he says, oh, he wants to have these sunsets in it and that kind of thing, but that won't hold up. And anyway, that's my point, is he's a bad person and he's going to continue to do bad things. And that was my argument to Justin Raimondo a year ago in Washington, D.C. We were both there at the Israel conference thing that Giraldi put on. And Grant Smith, and that's what I told Justin then. He's a bad person, so he's going to keep crossing you. And it's just, the question is, where's your line? But that's who he is. He's a bad person, and he's going to keep doing the wrong thing. And lying about why he does the wrong thing, too, like he did this morning on the Today Show. Damn hard breaks. Hang on a second. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation.
And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, so I'm sorry. First of all, I called Rand Paul a liar right when I had to go to break. So first, let me play for you audio of Rand Paul being a liar. I hope there's no other tabs open going to make any noise here. Let's see. All right, good. Here we go.
I'm doing the right thing. I don't know. My sense of trust is a little bit lost.
Let me ask you about something else she mentioned before her remarks on the email. Talked about this open letter that you and 46 other Republican senators wrote and then signed and sent off to the leaders of Iran during very delicate negotiations over this nuclear deal. She said that you and the others were either trying to help Iran or undermine the commander-in-chief. Let me just ask you, if you're no longer Senator Rand Paul, but President Rand Paul, and you're trying to conduct foreign policy in the midst of delicate negotiations, would you want members of the Senate undermining that?
Well, I'm kind of one of the senators who's in favor of negotiations with Iran. I want there to be a peaceful outcome, but I want to strengthen the president's hand. So I want to strengthen his hand by saying, you know what, we've got a lot of hardliners, and we're going to have to get this agreement by Congress.
All right, that's it. There's no point. I don't want to listen to him anymore. That's his despicable, ridiculous lie. This weasel. Oh, no, I signed the letter telling the Iranians, why bother negotiate with us? We don't negotiate in good faith. Screw you. In order to strengthen the president's hand in the negotiations. In order to strengthen the president's hand. He's just a liar. He's just a liar. Someone argue, I don't think Justin would even argue that. Oh, yeah, no. Oh, in fact, I know for a fact he won't. I brought that up in the thing with Justin, the argument with Justin today, and he said that, no, he had said the same thing to Megyn Kelly, too. I did this to help the negotiations, and Megyn Kelly laughed at him and said, well, that's a unique interpretation of the letter. Yeah, because it's a lie. A stupid, obvious lie. Why is Rand Paul such a liar? Oh, the thing that I did? Well, no, I did it for the exact opposite reason than what it obviously is. It's an attempt to obstruct, and the reason he did it is because he's sucking up to the war party, and that's it. He's sucking up to Netanyahu. Sucking up to Sheldon Adelson. He thinks that his personal ambition will be 0.1% better off if he sidles up to evil on this one. And so he did. That's why it's about as transparent as outer space. Pure air. A pure airless vacuum of clarity. With no refraction whatsoever going on. Oh no, I did it to help Obama negotiate. No, you just flip-flopped again and now you're lying again about why. Just like he lied when he said, I never said that we should suspend foreign aid to Israel. Oh, but Rand, it's on YouTube, dude. And all he has to say is, oh, I'm backing down from that now because heaven forbid. But geez, all I meant was that overall the American people oppose all foreign aid. And Israel is a very powerful, very bestest ally of ours. And I think they could probably do well without us. But anyway, no, yeah, right. He could have weaseled out of it a little without lying, without claiming that I never said that. But dude, We got all the, it's on the YouTube, man. He's saying it. The audio, the video, the numerous reporters around you scribbling it down. The official press release that you put out. Crying out loud. And so, look, and this is the whole thing, man. This goes back to one of the questions in the chat room is, you know, how can Justin be so hard on everybody who was right about Rand all along? And the answer is because Justin convinced himself that the only people who don't like, the only libertarians who don't like Rand are people who just want to trade at their little farmer's market in their little agorist community and not care about anything else in the world and who refuse to participate or even, you know, be interested in politics as a matter of high, holy anarchist principle when, in fact, we got a real fight on our hands and let's win it and whatever. And, of course, that's a straw man argument, and I argue with him about that before, and I argue with him about that on Twitter this morning. The truth is, and you can hear my interview with this young lady from Liberty Wing, Marcella, who interviewed me just the other day, I am the world's greatest or worst, whichever you prefer, Ron Paul bot on the planet. I worship Ron Paul. Again, if I ever got my act together, I'd get that portrait of him and hang him over my fireplace like people do with old portraits of FDR. You know, that official portrait of Ron Paul for his like congressional office picture. I worship Ron Paul. I love Ron Paul. I've met Ron Paul in person a handful of times. I've interviewed him on the phone about probably 30 times or something. And I think that what Ron Paul did for humanity by running for president twice was pretty much the greatest thing anybody ever did for humanity. And spreading purist, pretty damn near purist, individualist, enlightenment thinking to 7 billion humans is the greatest speaking tour on behalf of liberty ever. And, you know, every speech he gave on the House floor before that was in some small measure heroic. For, you know, 15 years. And I absolutely worship Ron Paul, and I absolutely approve of his strategy of being elected to Congress so that he could, as a critic once wrote to the Houston Chronicle, write articles, give speeches, and vote no. And do it in a way that people can really learn the truth about sound money and peace and freedom. About human rights. So, just like most of the people who can't stand Rand Paul, they're either warmongers like Jennifer Rubin, who will never trust him no matter how bad he mongers war. And those of us who are heartbroken that his apple has fallen so far from the tree, that he's willing to compromise on things that should be absolute matters of hard and fast principle. He stands for nothing but himself. He's Hillary Clinton with a perm. Well, so you ask me a question, huh? Well, let me run through the complex trigonometry in my head and figure out whether in the end I think I could get a slight advantage by saying this, or by saying that, or by saying the third thing. Let me think. Okay, I think I'll gain the slightest advantage if I say this instead of that. That's how his mind works, and you can see it. And if you Google his name and flip-flop, you get 300,000-plus results. For, yep, Rand Paul changed his position again. Even in his supposedly heroic drone speech, the original one, not even follow-up questions. In the original speech, he said he's okay with domestic cops using drones to kill people, just not the CIA or the military. It's in there. Oh, and just not American citizens. You got a green card?
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, our first guest on the show today is our friend Ray McGovern of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Welcome back to the show. Ray, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Scott.
Good, good. Oh, I need to turn you up and put my headphones on, too, I think, so I can hear you good. I'm glad to hear that. Very happy to have you back on the show. So, you guys put out a thing here. We reposted it on the antiwar.com blog. U.S. Intel vets oppose Brennan's CIA plan. This is a memorandum for the president, who I'm sure reads antiwar.com every day, from VIPS, the VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And in fact, well, let me click on this thing here, Ray, so I can mention a few of the veteran intelligence professionals who have signed this letter with you here. Got some pretty kind of household names. Larry Johnson, former CIA officer. John Kiriakou, fresh out of prison, where he was locked up for doing the right thing there. Colleen Rowley, FBI whistleblower, and Peter Van Buren from the State Department. Lawrence Wilkerson. Colin Powell's former right-hand man, and Ann Wright, the former diplomat who resigned over the Iraq War. So those are some veteran intelligence professionals, that's for sure. And so what's the big deal about Brennan's CIA plan? Wait, what's Brennan's CIA plan, and what's the big deal about it?
Well, Scott, he wants to sound the death knell for what Truman had in mind when he created the CIA way back in 1947.
All right, well, three cheers for him then, right? What's wrong with that? That's what we all want, right?
Well, yeah. The problem is whether you throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let me explain. Truman wanted nothing more nor less than an analysis group which would have access to all the information on a given subject, given country, or issue, therefore central, okay, and would be answerable only to him, would be able to tell the truth without fear or favor, and, as I enjoyed for almost my entire career of 27 years, and have professional protection, career protection for telling the truth. There's many a four-star general whose nose I knocked out of joint, and he would come to my superiors, and you got to get rid of McGovern, and they would say, to their credit, no, we think he's right. We think your bombing of Vietnam is not going to work, okay? That kind of thing. Now, that's all Truman had in mind, and when covert action started, and this was really an accident of the post-war period, what happened was the very brave and very imaginative members of the Office of Strategic Services, the fabled OSS, when they came back from the war, I'm talking World War II, all right, they came back and they said, well, thanks for all the applause, and it was well-deserved applause. Now, do you want us to, do you want us to hang around here, or should we go back to our corporations, our law firms, our universities? What do you want us to do? Okay, we're talking 1946, 1947. The Russians had just taken over in Eastern Europe. The KGB is running all over the world, overthrowing governments. Our guys, OSS people, are really good at overthrowing governments. So the question answered itself. Yeah, we need you guys. Sure, yeah, hang around. Don't go back to your law firms or, you know, corporations or academe, stay with us. Okay. Then the question became, where do we put these guys? Now, there's where the structural fault was introduced. Someone said, hey, we're creating this analysis group called the CIA, and they're going to have to be secret because some of the methods they will use to collect, I emphasize, collect information that the analysts need, they'll have to be spies and stuff. So they're going to be all secret. So let's put these guys in with all the analysts. Big, big mistake, because you can't have people doing covert action, people running wars, and have the analysts expect to have any credence or credibility at all in Congress or anywhere else. If you have the same chief running the war and you have analysts underneath that chief, I'm thinking Bill Casey under Reagan, for example, running the war in Nicaragua. Now, how is an analyst whose career depends on Bill Casey, how is he going to go up to Congress and Congress says, so what do you think about this prospect, the Russians that could come through Nicaragua, through Mexico, up into Texas? What do you think of that? The analyst would have to laugh and say, you know, well, I don't know where you get that. Well, I guess I do know where you get that, but, you know, that's a fool's errand. It's never going to happen. Well, how is he going to say that if his boss is running the war? So that's just one example. Another one, which we adduce in this memo, which not many people know, has to do with curveball. Now, hopefully most of your listeners know about curveball. He was this pretend scientist out of Iraq that appeared to the German service, and the German service debriefed him, and he had this tale about mobile biological weapons laboratories in Iraq, okay? Could he show us where they were? No. Do we have any images or pictures? No, we don't. But we had a really neat story, which Colin Powell and the others said, hey, you know, this will be really, really, really persuasive. Let's do this at the UN. We don't need images. We can get our graphics people to do artists' renderings of these trailers. And all the while, only one member of the intelligence community in this country had a chance to talk to Curveball and decided that he was a loony. They didn't know what he's talking about, and he wasn't who he pretended to be. So that's all by introduction. I just want to read you two sentences or so about this fellow who found out, Colin Powell, I just read a draft of his speech. He's going to use that oddball curveball to justify information about mobile biological weapons trailers. So this is what he says to his boss. And bear in mind that his boss is involved in operations as well as intelligence. And so he's not got a clear, tell it like it is kind of purview. So the analyst says to his superior, hey, I just found out about this curveball stuff. This is crazy. Colin Powell's going to say that there's no question about, quote, the validity of the information. So he writes that to his deputy chief of the CIA Iraqi task force. Again, bear in mind, there are operatives involved here as well as analysts. This is the answer he gets back. Very brief, but I hope you all listen. Quote, let's keep in mind the fact that this war is going to happen regardless of what Curveball said or didn't say, and that the powers that be probably aren't terribly interested in whether Curveball knows what he's talking about or not. Period. End quote. So there's the deputy chief of the Iraq task force who knows that the president and the suborned director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, and John McLaughlin, his deputy, have all been enlisted in this attempt to fabricate. It wasn't a mistake, this intelligence. It was fraud, okay? To fabricate intelligence to, quote, justify, end quote, a war of aggression, which, of course, Nuremberg defined as the most despicable war crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contains the cumulative evil of the whole. Think torture, think kidnapping, think of all the other indignities that our troops and our CIA people were ordered to do.
All right. That's almost the whole segment. So when we get back, I'm going to argue with you a bit about some of this stuff.
Good.
But right now, I'll remind everybody that the article is U.S. Intel Vets Oppose Brennan's CIA Plan. It's by Ray McGovern and the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And you can find it at antiwar.com/blog. And it's about John Brennan's plan to mix up the covert ops side with the analyst side and into, I guess, one big series of joint task forces, which is causing a major upset here. So hang on one second. Things will get worse. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, on the Liberty Radio Network. I'm talking with Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity. For 27 years, he was an analyst at the CIA, and he's been an anti-war guy this whole century, at least. Now, so Ray, part of what you're talking about, I totally understand what you're saying here, that you take a joint task force of analysts and operatives on a question like Iraq, and they are going to be more willing to fix the facts around the policy than a bunch of analysts in a room who, like in mythical old days when you worked there, would really be protected by their boss for really saying what they think is the truth no matter what and no matter who likes it and that kind of thing. But here's my thing about that, is the lies that Colin Powell told at the UN almost entirely, I believe, excluded the Scooter Libby Douglas Feith list of completely ridiculous talking points from the CIA's trash. It was instead what the CIA would vouch for, which was a lot of lies. And it was the CIA who, you know, on one hand, you can see, wow, they were under a lot of pressure when Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and Newt Gingrich, representing Richard Perle and the Defense Policy Board over there at the Pentagon, made, well, at least 14 trips between Cheney and Libby. I'm not sure how many times Gingrich went over there to pressure these guys to come up with fake Iraq intel. As you said, oh, he got weapons of mass destruction like manna from heaven, huh? Because back before he didn't have any anymore. And now all of a sudden he's got some. And the CIA went along with that. Instead of saying, you know what? The vice president is trying to make me lie and that makes me fold my arms crossed and get all upset and makes me, you know, extra determined to not lie about this. Instead, they lied. They went right along. And, you know, I read Paul Pilar all the time, and I like the way he writes a lot of anti-war stuff, but Paul Pilar's signature is at the bottom of that Iraq NIE from 2002 that says, oh, yeah, warehouse is full of mustard and sarin and VX. And that wasn't all, you know, the task force. That was the analysts. And they were apparently, if not perfectly happy, they were pretty damn happy to lie us into war, almost as bad as the guys in the Office of Special Plans. Right or wrong?
It's complicated. Paul Pilar has pretty much done penance. He feels very bad about having been dragooned into the rest of the exercise there and actually being supervisor of the declassified summary of the National Intelligence Estimate, which, quote, justified, end quote, the intelligence for the war, and even eliminated some of the qualifiers. So that was done. Now, why was it done? It was done because there was no integrity at the very top of the CIA. George Tenet, John McLaughlin, his deputy, lied. They lied because the president told them to lie. Now, how do I know that? Well, there's lots of ways I know that, but perhaps something your listeners don't know is that when Mike Isikoff was writing his book, which he called Hubris.
That's a Newsweek reporter, everybody.
That's right. Yeah. He's very, very bright. He was the one that actually divulged the Bill Clinton escapade with that young woman. Anyhow, he's a very good reporter, and he asked Carl Ford, who then was the head of the Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, okay, and said, Carl, what do you think about all this stuff about the, not mistaken, but fraudulent intelligence? And Carl Ford said, George Tenet and John McLaughlin lied. They knew they were lying. They should be shot, period, end quote. Now, I'm against capital punishment, but you know, I might make an exception for these two. They lied through their teeth. And what Ford was referring to was their last gasp effort to save Curveball. They found some trailers in Iraq, and that evening, Tenet and McLaughlin themselves drafted a memo to the president who happened to be in Poland and said, we found them! We found the bio trailers! Now, they called a fellow up in the Defense Intelligence Agency who they knew they could dragoon into coordinating, in quotes, this, and so they represented it as an interagency memo. The president got up in Krakow and he said, we found the weapons of mass destruction, they're there! Guess what happens? Colin Powell comes into the office the next morning. Larry Wilkerson says, there's this cockamamie report that Tenet and McLaughlin did last night without checking with our analysts. And of course, it's wrong. These things have nothing to do with biological weapons development. Colin Powell goes crazy. He sends Carl Ford out to the CIA. He had already been asked to come out there by Tenet and McLaughlin to read the riot act to him for telling Colin Powell that this was all a crock. So he gets on the carpet there, literally, in the director's conference room, and Tenet has at him. And Carl Ford says, look, you guys, that is the worst piece of intelligence analysis that I've run into in my long career. You guys did it. I'm not taking back anything. I've told Colin Powell this was a crock, and that's what it is. Now, it was that vignette that caused Carl Ford to be very, very undiplomatic and State Department type parlance.
Well, and the State Department's intelligence agency, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, had debunked the aluminum tubes along with the Department of Energy as well, which the CIA was sticking with.
Yeah, and Scott, too. That leads to another important point. Tom Finger, who was Carl Ford's deputy and who became head, that is, Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, he was enlisted to come in a couple of years later after the debacle on Iraq. They asked him to do an honest estimate on Iran.
Right, the 07 NIE.
Yeah, he said, no way will I do that. And they said, no, you got to do that. You're the only...
All right, now time is short. Let me get this thing back on track here. The okay. CIA and their lies are bad enough, whether it's George Tenet or Robert Gates or David Petraeus, but you're arguing that this new reorganization is going to make it that much worse, where the analysts, never mind that all the analysts are nothing but drone targeters now anyway, they're going to be even more just beholden to the operations officers and the policymakers and coming up with whatever lies to justify what's going on. That's going to be even further institutionalized. The dishonesty of the CIA is going to be even further institutionalized by this. It sounds like is what you're saying. But so is there much of a counter argument to that even worth bothering with, or should we move on to Ukraine here in our last couple of minutes?
Well, let's do two things very quickly. Yes, this is your diagnosis, and I would put it another way and say it's going to be harder, much harder for a guy like Tom Finger to come in and do an honest estimate, which prevented a war against Iran during the last year of the Bush regime. That is really important. Now, you mentioned drones. Okay, well, who's going to sit back and say, aren't drones creating more terrorists? Nobody. Everybody's targeting the drones. Nobody's analyzing the situation to find out why they hate us, why they're permitted, why they commit suicide to do us in. Nobody.
Right.
Right. Now, Ukraine.
Let me ask you about Ukraine real quick.
Sure.
The Americans, the NATO is leaking again these fake accusations debunked by the Germans that the Russians are invading again. They're sending their infantry across. Which is, of course, not true, and debunked in Der Spiegel. But then, so the question is, why? Is Barack Obama, or is Barack Obama's government, anyway, trying to destroy Minsk II and undermine the peace deal that the Germans and French have worked out with the Russians here, Ray? very quickly, please, sir.
They're trying to, yeah. But the good news is that the Germans finally, you know, 70 years after World War II, are coming out of their adolescence into manhood or womanhood, into adulthood. And they're seeing that their interests are not the same as the United States' interests. They wanted to prevent the arming of Ukraine by the U.S., and they, I think, have successfully done that. There's never been a more significant rift in the Atlantic Alliance since George Bush decided to do a war of aggression against Iraq.
Well, so that's a very good thing. But now, and they have actually announced that they're withholding the trainers for a short time, but the U.K. is still sending some. Is it the U.S. and the U.K. versus the French and the Germans here? And will they be able to screw this up? Because they have a lot of influence in Kiev still, right?
Yeah, they can screw it up, and they've got Nazis and proto-fascists to help them do it. I think what Poroshenko was told by Putin and by Angela Merkel, and perhaps by Hollande, who was just there for window dressing, but he was told, look, you know, it's not going to happen. The Russians aren't going to back down, and we're not going to help you anymore. Let the U.S. try to wage this war so many thousands of miles away from its shore. We're not going to do it. We're going to put the kibosh on the neocons who, you know, have disrespect for us in any case. I think that's what happened. I think Poroshenko has the message. The neocons will still make their tries, but I think this time Minsk II is much more likely to hold than the initial Minsk agreement.
Great. Thank you so much for your time on the show, Ray. Appreciate it.
Most welcome.
In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, Joe, welcome back to the show.
Sorry, Phil, for calling you a couple of minutes earlier than I meant to there, leaving you on hold through all that crap. So, Phil Giraldi, everybody, welcome back to the show. Phil, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. A couple of good articles here. One of them's at antiwar.com and uns.com. Shutting down AIPAC, removing Israel from American politics. And then another one brand new today, I think, at the American Conservative, How Governments Twist Terrorism. So I hadn't read that one yet, but sounds interesting. But first of all, let's talk about Israel. And actually, Phil, let's do it this way. I'll introduce you like this because I need to get to this. Former CIA officer, now executive director of the Council for the National Interest in Washington, and then again, a writer for uns.com and the American Conservative magazine. And so This article is actually the text of a great speech that you gave on the eve, pretty much at least by a day, of Netanyahu's speech, and really giving a great overview of how you see America and Israel's relationship. So I would ask you to kind of give that overview, assuming an audience of people who aren't familiar with any real criticism of Israel, maybe, and as far as they know, hey, they're our greatest ally and all of that. So really, what is your beef, Phil? Let them know.
Yeah, well, basically, I was debunking the idea that Israel is a great ally, or that it indeed is even a country that would qualify as a friend. The track record of Israel through the years certainly has indicated quite the contrary. Israel is almost every year the leading friendly country in terms of spying against the United States. Certainly Israel has involved the United States in wars in the Middle East, has basically used the United States to defend its own policies and its own wars to the detriment of U.S. interests. And I lay all this out in the speech, and the speech basically is intended to, you know, address the issue of is this relationship in any way valuable or helpful for the United States? And I come to the conclusion that it is not. And indeed, beyond that, it's not even good for Israel. Israel, having been empowered to do things that are beyond its reach and that are in the long term damaging, has not been good for Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, let's focus on that for a minute. I think that's a very important point there. Well, I don't know. I don't necessarily want to ask you for a counterfactual. How might it be instead? But could you explain, you know, in what ways you think that their power's been distorted, and how things have been made different than they otherwise would have been?
Well, I mean, Israel has a history of attacking its neighbors. I'm sure you know all the incidents as much as I do. But Israel wouldn't have done a lot of these things and wouldn't have done the aggressive seizure of Arab land on the West Bank and its treatment of Gaza and its attacks on Lebanon and so on and so forth without the knowledge that the United States would protect it in the UN Security Council and that the United States would basically bail it out by providing more weapons and more money and more political support.
Well, and that's the thing that's always left out of the narrative on TV, especially, is that all the Arab states in the region, and including the Palestinian Authority, have said, now I guess the Palestinian Authority, maybe they were last on the list to say so, and that was back in 1988, that, okay, we'll recognize the state of Israel, but just end the occupation. And so, but it's always portrayed as though Israel is completely surrounded by implacable enemies, but in fact, without our support for their bullying, they might just accept that same status quo that the rest of the region has already decided to accept on their behalf, really.
Yeah, I mean, they keep citing what they claim is that the Hamas is going to, you know, destroy Israel, kill all the Jews and everything like that. But, there's no real evidence for this kind of animus. Hamas is a resistance movement that was, in fact, created by Israel, or encouraged by Israel, at least. And the fact is that this is part of their jargon and so on and so forth. All of Israel's neighbors accept the reality of Israel, and this is often overlooked, and certainly overlooked by people like Netanyahu when they come here for a visit. And the fact is that there have been a number of Arab resolutions tabled to recognize Israel and to establish normal relations, and that means embassies and the whole thing, but subject to Israel basically pulling back to the 68 lines and allowing the creation of a Palestinian state. So this whole narrative has been shaped in kind of the reverse direction by Israel's propagandists in the United States, primarily, and it's quite wrong.
Yeah, it's funny, too, about the narrative about the United Nations and how, well, America is protecting poor little Israel from the rest of the mean old world ganging up on them without... It seems like you could only believe that if you just refuse to entertain the opposite position for even a moment to check if maybe the rest of the world has a point about what's going on there. And usually I think that comes down to the people that narrative works on mostly in America are people who have never really been shown a map and don't really understand about the War of 67 and the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem ever since then. They think of Palestine as some sort of neighboring territory, if not a state, rather than a place that's already conquered and under occupation for all this time.
Yeah, and of course there's also the Christian Zionists who basically any historical argument they don't care about. All they care about is the fact that their interpretation of the Bible, which of course is by no means universal, tells them that basically they have to support Israel for their own reasons, which generally come down to their desire to see the second coming of Christ, of which the establishment of Israel is a precursor. So it has nothing to do with reality or with politics or history. It has a lot to do with this faith-based emotion.
All right, now, so when you say that they have a role in involving the United States in wars, can you be more specific about that?
Yeah, I think it's clear that Israel was not the sole reason that we invaded Iraq, but it was a major contributor. The Israeli government got on board very quickly. Initially, it was somewhat reluctant because it wanted the United States to attack Iran instead. But they got onto the war, and certainly the pro-Israel community in the United States, and particularly the neocons, of course, were the initiators of the war. So you have to say Israel is kind of in the matrix of what happened in terms of the invasion of Iraq. Israel has also been basically the genesis of America's counterterrorism policy comes out of Israel. Essentially, rather than Israel adopting American policies, it's gone the other way. Israel has basically, which has had, of course, terrorism issues for quite some time, has evolved certain policies that are one might regard as very repressive. And the United States has basically taken these over as our own policies. So that this involvement in the global war on terrorism is to a certain extent derivative from Israel. And the U.S. has been a target of terrorism because of the relationship with Israel. And then finally, of course, the case of Iran. There is nobody arguing that, or nobody sane arguing that Iran threatens the United States. But yet we're seeing this very week and last week evidence that there is an extremely powerful war party in the U.S. Senate and elsewhere that wants us essentially to go to war with Iran.
Well, and it doesn't seem like they have any support within the military, but let me ask you real quick then. Well, very short on time for this segment, but if they're able to scotch the negotiations – say their letter works and it causes enough to send inside the government of Iran to scotch the thing from their end and that kind of thing, then is that really a path to war there? Or, don't worry, they still are under the safeguards agreement and everything is, you know, still status quo is not a crisis. It's only a fake crisis after all.
Yeah, but we're seeing an escalation of a fake crisis since 1993 when Netanyahu first started complaining about Iran. They have a powerful voice in Congress and in the media. And the fact is that they do want a war. They want the United States to eliminate Iran as a military competitor to Israel. So it's not just an issue of nuclear weapons. It's an issue of Iran as a competitor in that region. And, they want a war, and we've seen many instances in the last 50 years, certainly, where people who want war very passionately and are well-placed are very often able to do that.
All right, hold it right there. It's Phil Giraldi from the American Conservative and UNS.com. We'll be right back. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. Talking with Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, writer for the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com. That's UNZ, UNS.com. And we're talking about this speech, Shutting Down AIPAC, which is maybe not the best title for it, but it's a great, great article for you to read there. It's linked at antiwar.com today as well. And maybe we'll get into this other one at the American Conservative about terrorism in a minute. But where the break interrupted, we were talking about how the neocons and I guess the Israeli government, is that the same thing? The Likud party and the neoconservative movement in America, they want war with Iran and they won't rest. Even if they can't get one now, they're going to keep trying to get one tomorrow, kind of a thing. And it's certainly the case that it's been reported time and again that the neocons, the only country they ever wanted to bomb more than Iraq was Iran, and that was what they wanted and tried to get from the very beginning after the September 11th crisis began. And I was reminded when you were talking there, Phil, about the leak, and this was, I think, if I remember right, it was confirmed by the two majors, New York Times and Washington Post, that
Dick Cheney had sent David Wurmser around to AEI and maybe a couple of other neocon think tanks and kind of, for whatever reason, deliberately leaking to them to get it out that he was considering an end run around the President of the United States and that he would make a deal with Ehud Olmert and would get Ehud Olmert to attack Iranian interests in the Persian Gulf in order to force Bush's hand and have him do it. And if I remember right, when the New York Times, et cetera, confirmed it, they were like, yeah, this is basically what happened here. And all they did was, you know, confirm that, yeah, Wurmser was the leaker, all right. And I wonder if you think that that kind of thing is still a danger, even under an Obama presidency, who clearly has no interest in starting a war with Iran himself.
Yeah, I think there's always danger of this kind of thing happening. And you know, we talk about various options like false flag attacks, contrived attacks. I mean, you know, it was also reported in the media, I guess about a year ago, that Israeli case officers, Mossad officers, were going around pretending to be American case officers, you know, and having American, they have American passports and all this kind of thing. Think about that. If
you and
really
recruiting terrorists in Iran, right?
Yeah, and recruiting terrorists to attack Iran.
Yeah.
And so you go around and you contrive a situation where the people on the receiving end think they're dealing with Americans, and they stage an incident which in could lead to war. It's something that can be easily contrived. I had a when I spoke on Sunday at the AIPAC thing, I had someone came up and asked me about Charlie Hebdo, and I said, look, I said I could probably set up a false flag for something like Charlie Hebdo. And have somebody completely unwittingly, part of a conspiracy, killing somebody that leads to other things that were completely unanticipated. It's not that hard to do. This stuff isn't that difficult to do. You get people that are passionately involved in causes, and their rationality gets suspended. And that's what you rely on in these kinds of cases. And sure, once you're completely hostile and you're face to face with a country like Iran, all it needs is a little trigger to get something going. And that's what my concern would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Seymour Hersh also talked about how Cheney and I guess must have been Libby and them and Wurmser floated the idea that maybe they would have maybe you remember it better than me, but wasn't it something like special forces would attack the American Navy in the Persian Gulf?
Yeah.
Not that they went through with it, but that they had at least talked about that in the vice president's office?
Yeah. And recently Erdogan in Turkey with his intelligence chief was talking about the same thing, attacking the Turkish soldiers who were guarding the mausoleum inside Syria and making it look like it was done by the Syrian government. So, this kind of stuff, it floats to the top all the time.
All right, now let's talk a little bit more about the lobby and its power inside the United States. There's this famous article in The New Yorker by Jeffrey Goldberg back from 2005 called Real Insiders. It's about Steve Rosen, who, of course, was involved in a plan to steal documents relating to the Bush administration's highest-level councils on what they were going to do about Iran. And they were stealing this information to give it to the Israeli embassy, to give to the Israeli government to figure out how to better lie us into that war, in fact. But anyway, in this article, point being that Rosen is quoted as saying, a lobby is like a night flower. It thrives in the dark and dies in the sun. And of course, this is also the source of the famous quote about how he could get 70 senators. You see this napkin? I could have 70 senators sign this thing in 24 hours. But what I want to ask you about is the night flower thing, because it seems to me like they've had some pretty high-profile engagements, in public view in the past couple of years, including the war against Chuck Hagel, the attempted war against Syria in 2013, and a couple of major public fights with Obama about sanctions in Iran. Now you have Netanyahu coming to town, and the whole public partisan this and that kind of politics surrounding that. And then now you have this letter from the Republican senators, which seems to have really made people angry. And The Hill has a story today that this letter has just completely backfired and made the Republicans look like such idiots. And I wonder whether you think the tide is turning at all, if the sun is shining now on this night flower, and that everybody, hey, look at Israel's role in American politics.
Yeah, I think that the certainly the last 2 weeks have been a public relations disaster, both for Netanyahu and for the lobby, no question about it. But I think the seeds of this were there before. I think that if you're going back a year or so, you would discover that there's been a lot more discussion about the role of the lobby. I said a year ago that I thought the lobby was dead. But it just hasn't figured that out yet and hasn't rolled over. The fact is that the Israel lobby is increasingly having to come out in the open and is defending the indefensible in terms of what Netanyahu has been doing. The attack on Gaza last summer and everything like that, in which so many civilians died. I think it opened a lot of eyes to the fact that this is just not defensive stuff. This is not a country, acting defensively to protect its interests and stuff like that. This is goes way beyond that. So I think the lobby is basically losing the information war, losing the perspective war in terms of what's going on in the Middle East, and eventually it's going to lose. But, it could take 20 years to die. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, as you were saying before, you have the hardcore force Jesus to come back, small minority even of evangelical Christians. But then I think most other people who are just sort of, basically biased toward Israel, mostly just have never even heard the other side of the story at all. And that's really what they're victims of, that when there's cracks in the narrative whatsoever, and they really start to understand the abuse of human rights at the hands of the Israelis on a daily basis, things become much clearer. And I think that's really what's happening here. So,
Some people certainly believe that the fault is not so much in terms of our political class, but it's in the media, because the media does not tell the story the way it is, or the way it would for any other country.
But more and more, the American conservative and UNS.com are getting around that, and that's what's really making the difference. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
That's Phil Giraldi, UNS.com and theamericanconservative.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, if I had a do-over of my speech from last Friday, I'd have done it all different, man. I don't know why I did this stupid, dumb thing I did. It's because I didn't know what to do, so I just did the same old thing. But what I should have done was I should have just talked about, hey, there's a giant sectarian war in the Middle East. It's all George W. Bush's fault. He started it. It's not a religious war. It's a sectarian war based on who's who, not who believes what. You understand? But anyway, that's what's going on. And then to just describe that is to describe the complete absurdity of the American position in the whole thing, and the cruelty of it. And could have made a great little talk there. So, sorry, New Hampshire, for not giving a good enough speech. But that's what I was thinking. I should have started at the present instead of going way back. Should have just started at the present and said, here's what the hell's going on. Does that make any sense to you? I know, me neither, but here's why it's like this. Now, does that make any sense to you either? I know. Isn't it crazy? Well, it's because Richard Perle is an idiot. Say it with me now. He's not just mean and nasty. He's dumb. Only a real smart guy like Richard Perle could be as stupid as Richard Perle. Come on, you know the type. Yeah, exactly. All right. What do you get when you combine the interests of a foreign power and personal profit and stupidity all together in the head of one head of the Defense Policy Board in a Republican administration? Rivers of blood. Come on.
Everybody knows that. That's how it goes. All right. So listen. There's this interesting article in the Washington Post. Wait, don't change the channel. It's called Three Times U.S. Foreign Policy Helped to Create the Islamic State. And I have a massive criticism of it, okay? I'm not saying this is the end all of whatever. It's the Washington Post. And I actually tweeted the guy a comment, and I don't think I was being too snarky, but he didn't answer. But that's all right. Three times U.S. foreign policy helped to create the Islamic State. So I thought, well, I probably know what this is going to say. But he brought up a couple of things I hadn't really thought of, or not very hard about anyway. So the first thing is he says the war in Afghanistan has helped Al-Qaeda, or has helped the Islamic State. And that, well, you know, it used to be their caliphate was in no man's land over there. Mullah Omar was the caliph. And it was over there in Pashtunistan, and who gave a damn? But then by smashing the caliphate in Afghanistan, drove them west. Go west, young jihadist, all the old Taliban said. And so that's where they went, and George Bush met them there. And that's number two on the list, the war in Iraq, of course. Getting rid of the Sunni secular fascist Saddam Hussein and empowering the Shiite death squads of the Iranian-backed Badr Brigade in their civil war to take the capital city and drive all the Sunnis out, and driving the Sunni population then into the arms of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who, as they get right in here, didn't get along with al-Qaeda before, said he wanted to focus on fighting the King of Jordan, and that bin Laden didn't really approve of his sectarianism against the Shiites. Bin Laden wanted to see all Muslims together against the Western infidels, and no need to fight over Sunni Shia anyway. Whereas Zarqawi had a much harder line on the situation. And of course, when it came to Iraq, bin Laden was hiding in the attic over in Pakistan. So Zarqawi got to call those shots. And importantly, and he doesn't quite clarify this the way I would like, but importantly, Zarqawi never declared loyalty to bin Laden until the very end of 2004. So a full year and three quarters into the war. A full year and 9 months after the invasion and occupation began, only then did Zarqawi declare loyalty to bin Laden, even though Colin Powell used him as an excuse to invade, as though he was somehow the pretend link between Osama and Saddam, when Saddam wanted him dead and Osama and him had agreed to not do business previously. Anyway, and then he says the death of Osama bin Laden. By killing bin Laden, they turned Al-Qaeda over to Zawahiri, or Zawahiri, or whatever. But, he doesn't have that much charisma. He had bin Laden's ear, but that doesn't mean he has the ability to command forces. And then, as he says here, during the war in Syria, when Zawahiri told Baghdadi to go back to Iraq, he had no means to enforce it whatsoever, so he made an ass out of himself, basically. And Baghdadi said, "What's Iraq, Ayman? I don't know what you're talking about, dude." And since he was the one, the warlord, actually on the ground getting work done, while Zawahiri's hiding in somebody's basement somewhere 2,000 miles east of there, he declared his caliphate and went ahead and did what he wanted to do there. And now, of course, what's left out of this article, which it's a pretty damn good article for the Washington Post, man, you gotta admit. But what's left out here is what Syrian civil war? The one that Assad would have won in no time flat if America and America's allies had not been backing the rebellion all along. The war that would have been over a long time ago. I mean, that's mean as hell. The guy's a horrible fascist dictator, but that doesn't mean that America and Turkey and Saudi and Qatar and for Israel should all be working together. Israel now actually got a great article here about Israel helping out the al-Nusra Front at Loeb Log. And all Jim Loeb's doing is quoting the Weekly Standard. Here's the Weekly Standard saying, yeah, man, Israel's helping the al-Nusra Front because the enemy is Hezbollah. So goes without saying, right? According to the Weekly Standard, so... It sounds crazy, but it's Jim Loeb, Mr. Moderate,
quoting the Weekly Standard, the Mr. Israel, you know? They're not accusing Israel. They're saying, yep, here's what we're doing, guys, and a rationalization for it. And but anyway, the answer is that really the war was going on for a good year before the al-Nusra Front was really a force to be reckoned with there. And it was not much of a war. It took about that long for it to become a war, for al-Nusra to turn it into a real war. I mean, there were some skirmishes and some fighting in 2011, but it was really in 2012 that the al-Nusra Front, they started with the suicide attacks and started major battles, and the civil war really got going. And you don't have to go further. Oh, you can. You may. But you needn't go further than the New York Times and the Washington Post saying, yep, the CIA is helping the Turks and the Qataris and the Saudis organize a bunch of money and a bunch of guns to go to the rebels, the moderate ones, hopefully. But then even the New York Times, when it confirms your bias, you say, even the New York Times confirms my bias. Even David Sanger, the very worst reporter at the New York Times, which when it confirms your bias means you know it's definitely true then, he says, isn't that fun how that works? Like, even Bill Clinton says Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. He's the worst liar in our society. So that's how you know that it's true if he agrees with Bush. Same kind of thing. Even David Sanger said, hey, all the CIA's guns and money are going to the fighters. And who are the fighters? They're jihadists, man. They're veterans of the last war, America's war. They're not just the Sunni-based insurgency. They're al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who they are. That's who the al-Nusra Front were. They were openly loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri all along. Still are. And now you can read, and man, I couldn't make this stuff up for you. You wouldn't believe me if I did. But here it is in Reuters and in the New York Times about how they just want al-Nusra to renounce al-Qaeda and they'll give them money and guns and call them moderates now. You should just end this segment with that, right? Yeah. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Yeah, see there, I'm too good on Rand Paul. I'm pushing Raimondo back into his camp. Should back off a little bit. Anyway. I'm sorry, man. Sometimes I go off on tangents and then I run out of time for my segment. But I was making a point there about that Syrian war. When the guy in the Washington Post writes, here are some times that American policy helped strengthen the Islamic State, he left out the part about how America and its allies have supported the rebellion in Syria this whole time. Obama announced almost immediately when the protests began, his ambassador was over there interfering and encouraging people to uprise as well. Obama announced Assad must go. They had two meetings in Geneva, one and two, they called them. In both cases, the Americans said, Assad must go. And then when they settled for language that said, well, there has to be some kind of transition, the Americans said, that means Assad must go. Even though that wasn't the agreement of the rest of the whatever. And anyway, they tried to set up sock puppet governments, friends of Syria, and they would have these meetings. And I'm just talking about the last 2-3 years worth of history here, folks. Hillary Clinton would organize these friends of Syria meetings. I think one of them in Tunisia and one of them in, or one or two of them in Qatar. And, all along they told whatever factions that they were supporting that had any power at all. I don't know if it was enough to really make a difference or not, but they were telling them always, do not negotiate with the government. We've got your back. We're sending you guns and money. Keep fighting. You'll win eventually. And, you know, for that matter,
It's been reported on all of the motives, too. The Israelis and Americans have said, and again, even in the New York Times, where it's not a conspiracy theory, if it's in the New York Times, there it is in the New York Times. They go, well, you know, it's shades of World War II, Hitler versus Stalin. Hey, it's scorpions in a bottle. Let them fight. Kind of thing. Where people just have that attitude, and they're quoted saying, you know, at this point, doesn't look like the rebels are going to win against Assad outright, but then again, he's not winning against them outright either, and so they're weakening each other, which is a very zero-sum kind of idiotic way to look at it as well, when, of course, what they ended up doing with that policy was really splitting Syria into thirds. And now the cities are mostly in the west, in the part still controlled by the fascist dictatorship there. But about two-thirds of the country is under the control now of the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front. And again, al-Nusra is still loyal to al-Qaeda. ISIS, no longer. They're loyal to their own caliphate now. But that's the only real difference between them. And as Patrick Coburn has said, all the so-called moderates all along, they're basically no different than the al-Nusra fighters either. That's somebody who had talked to them. And so that's what created the Islamic State. All that happened last June was that the whole thing blew up right in their face, about as big as it possibly could have. And what did they think was going to happen? I don't know. Maybe this. Maybe they thought, hey, listen, we'll back the rebels and... you know, I don't know if they were really worried about what the consequences in Iraq would be. But I guess they figured, you know what, if we expedite the chaotic collapse, as David Wormser would say, in Syria, then, hell, who cares about putting it back together again as we see fit? Just let it collapse. Let it burn. And I guess they probably just assume, like with Iraq, whatever happens, it won't get too far out of hand, right? Until all those Toyotas that the U.S. gave the FSA go rolling on into Mosul. And anyway, so, but, you know, I don't know, man. I don't mean to sell everybody in government too short. It could very well be that they thought, you know what, if they end up really creating the caliphate, then great. You know, if that's a 50% chance, then good deal, man. Finally, we'll get to reinvade Iraq again. I got the clip here. I don't know. I got time to play it too, don't I? I bet I do. Of Jim Mikleshesky on NBC. Ah, hell, you believe me anyway. It's from 2009. The NBC reporter, Pentagon reporter, Jim Mikleshesky, saying, yeah, I'm here at the Pentagon, and Obama's giving his, I just got elected and sworn in as president, and I'm going to do like I said, only on a little bit longer timetable, and get the troops out of Iraq speech. And right before the speech, Mikleshesky saying, well, I'm here at the Pentagon, and they're saying, basically, they don't care what the president says. Iraq belongs to them, and they're going to stay for another 20 years. The hell is that clip, man? Well, I'm going to have to. Now I went and said a bunch of things about it. I'm going to have to find it. I know what folder it's in and everything. If I look carefully, maybe I can find it. Yeah, there it is. Pentagon Mikleshesky. I bet if I fast forward a little, it'd probably help.
What role has he played in arriving at this decision about troops for President Obama?
Well, I want to make two quick points about Secretary Gates. Even during the campaign, if you listen to what Secretary Gates was saying about the U.S. military operations in Iraq and what Barack Obama were saying, they were not that far apart. Secretary Gates, as early as 18 months to 2 years ago, was saying, look, everybody understands that we're going to have to start withdrawing from Iraq. But at the same time, Secretary Gates, adds this caveat that, in fact, he believes significant numbers of troops will remain in Iraq for years to come. And, in fact, military commanders, despite this standard of forces agreement with the Iraqi government that all U.S. forces would be out by the end of 2011, are already making plans for a significant number of American troops to remain in Iraq beyond that 2011 deadline, assuming that that SOFA agreement would be renegotiated. And one senior military commander told us that he expects large numbers of American troops to be in Iraq for the next 15 to 20 years, David.
15 to 20 years. I think that really takes a moment to really sink in with a mission that is primarily what over that kind of time horizon, Mick?
Well, it would evolve from, again, from a day-to-day combat mission to more of an oversight mission. And we mustn't forget that the U.S. is providing nearly 100% of all combat air support over Iraq, and that the Iraqi military is not going to be able to assume that mission within the next 18 months to 2 years. It's going to be impossible. And there are some discussions.
Hey, that reminds me of my one-half brilliant, one-half idiotic article that I wrote right at this time in 2009. And it was called Finding Ways to Stay in Iraq. And what it said was, what about air power? And then what about force protection for the air power? Sounds like a pretty big loophole there, dude. And one of the things, the reason I say half idiotic is I go back and read that article now and I have to laugh because I completely dismiss the possibility. This is at antiwar.com, finding ways to stay in Iraq. And I said, it's just completely idiotic to think that Al-Qaeda types could ever take over all of Sunnistan, even if it's independent. They were only ever the smallest part of the Sunni-based insurgency. And there's no way that they could ever actually rule all of Sunnistan. And so the local Sunnis and the Iraqi government have their own motive to keep those guys out and whatever. But boy, I just couldn't anticipate the highest treason imaginable by Barack Obama in backing the Mujahideen in Libya. And then again, especially in Syria, as Patrick Coburn warned all along, quote, re-energizing, if you're going to quote it, get the quote right, re-energizing the Sunni insurgency in Iraq and the strife between the Sunnis on the outs and the Maliki government and all of that, and making them feel like fighting again, you know, giving them something to do, somewhere to train, some guns to fire, another little gladiator academy for the next generation. Barack Obama continuing in the footsteps of George W. Bush to accomplish all of Osama bin Laden's goals for him. And, you know, the Islamic State, although they disavowed Zawahiri and told him that, you know, he can go give orders to himself in a room somewhere, they still claim bin Laden. They claim to be the true heirs of the Islamo-fascist caliphate that bin Laden always dreamt of. That was always a ridiculous, you know, crackhead pipe dream. Back when he wanted it, even as recent as the day he died, it was a pipe dream in 2011 until Barack Obama and Baghdadi accomplished it for him. It's amazing, isn't it? All right, see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.